Deranged Du Jour. We are two deranged lawyers talking about our deranged obsessions. I am Raven. I'm joined by my co-host.
I'm Pija.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Great. So now we know who we are. We're two deranged lawyers, as I said, talking about our deranged obsessions. And this month for you, we have the third episode in the progression from Ruby Ridge to January 6th, which is my ultimate obsession, Oklahoma City bombing. I did not know how obsessed I could become with a horrible tragedy. Unfortunately, I am deranged.
We didn't know.
Yeah, in case you didn't know, I am deranged. But then this ultimately happened. As I think, unless you're living under a rock or born after 2000, you probably know that Oklahoma City bombing happened on April 19th of 1995. So this was a culmination of a lot of grievances that were happening within the right-wing white supremacist circles that led Timothy McVeigh to do this heinous act. So taking a little bit of a step back, previously, if you didn't listen to our episodes on Ruby Ridge and Waco, I would recommend that you do in order to talk about this because they're very intertwined. It really has to do with a lot of government overreach in Ruby Ridge and in Waco that people were paying attention to, particularly people who were on the right in these white supremacist type of organizations. So in both of those situations, they involve a search warrant, a valid search warrant slash arrest warrant for criminal activity that both Randy Weaver and David Koresh were doing at the time. So this is a different situation. This is a situation in which one individual decided to take it upon his own accord and bomb a building in retaliation for Ruby Ridge and Waco. So I'm saying allegedly, obviously like there were other people who were involved. We know Terry Nichols. And unfortunately, we were going to be talking a lot more about Terry Nichols this time around, but our guest for today unfortunately had to cancel for understandable reasons, which Pisha is going to explain.
Yeah. After talking with Professor Barbara Bergman, who represented Terry Nichols, we had a nice discussion. But as lawyers, we totally understand the concern about oversharing information that could be privileged or protected under attorney-client communications. And so we did not want to do anything that would have jeopardized that privilege. We understand that. And we want to point out that Timothy McVeigh's lawyer, Mr. Stephen Jones, does not have the same concept of attorney-client privilege. He seems to think that, oh, my client's dead now, I can share whatever I want. Not true. Not true. So we're respecting the privilege that exists between Barbara and her client, Terry Nichols. And right. So we completely understand.
Right. It's there for a really important reason. And, you know, not to get too far into the weeds, but in America, where we live.
Land of the free.
Supposedly. The accused, people who are accused of crimes, have a right to a full and vigorous defense. And so in order to do that, you have to be able to have honest conversations with your lawyers. It doesn't necessarily, and I think like this needs to be said, it doesn't mean that the people who are accused are lying or anything like that. It's that the truth is really nebulous at times. And there's ways that you can talk about facts that make you seem more guilty than others. And so that's the purpose of having a criminal defense lawyer, is to present your case in a way that puts forward the facts that are the most relevant towards your defense.
It makes perfect sense. And I think we just want to encourage honest and open and transparent communications between clients and their attorneys. If they're afraid to share something because the only way they know how to say it sounds bad,
exactly,
the way you say it, then, you know, the attorney is able to parse that out much better than the average person is. And so that's why that privilege exists, so that these kind of open conversations can exist. And
right. So I personally had clients come up to me the first time I talked to them and they say, I'm guilty. And I have to take them back and be like, well,
there was this one time when I was in, there was this time in insurance defense where the lady walked up to me and was like, I was definitely on my cell phone when I ran that light. And I was like, oh, cool. Thank you for that information. But at least I know how to deal with it now. You know, it's not popping up at trial.
Right. And that's the reason that you want to have those conversations with your lawyers, is that they know how to handle those situations in a way that is in accordance with the law. So
exactly.
So unfortunately she couldn't be here, but I am so excited about this episode because I am going to take you guys down my rabbit hole that I've been down for the past like 3 weeks. So here we go. Just as a reminder of where we are in history, I talked about Waco and Ruby Ridge, but in addition to that, there is kind of this new surge of civil rights movement happening in the 1990s. But Bill Clinton was just elected in 19, and at the same time there was this new rise of like a new conservative movement happening that really led to a lot of the stuff that's happening today. Newt Gingrich being one of them, who was intent on just shutting down Clinton every step of the way. So that's kind of some of the backdrop, and there's some really just kind of vile and vitriolic rhetoric that's coming out of the right that's new. I mean, you can look back as far as the beginning of time and see vitriol in politics. I'm not saying it's anything new, but it became much more mainstream. There was this illusion, I think, of politics being somewhat cordial to some degree, some professional, you would say. But when Newt Gingrich and his ilk came into power, they really capitalized on the I think my dad called it this. I'm going to talk about my dad here just for a second. I know I'm kind of all over the place, but he calls it like a rage-gasm, and I totally love that phrase.
I love that phrase. Yeah, great phrase. Rage-gasm.
Yeah. Right. And I think part of the reason that Oklahoma City fascinated me so much, we were both children, basically, when this happened. But when I was growing up, my dad would listen to right-wing radio, not because he was into right wing stuff. Like, he's very liberal. He raised me right. We'll say that. But he would listen to it in order to understand the other side. And at the time, you know, when I'm a kid and even when I'm into my teenage years, I never understood it. But as, you know, as an adult, looking back at that, I find it really, I want to say refreshing in a way, to know, you know, he's really able to understand both sides in a way that I think has lost complete meaning in the rest of American
politics.
Well,
he hasn't lost dignity or integrity or respect by exploring the other side. And mm-hmm. I just want to say, we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but I tried so hard to be like your dad with something regarding Oklahoma City. We're going to talk about it later. I tried so hard. And the fact that he sat there and listened to Rush Limbaugh without turning it off the way I did when this incident happened, I'm so impressed is all I have to say. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of understanding. It takes a lot, and I didn't have it.
And I'm not saying that he wouldn't be absolutely livid at what they were saying, especially when they were the Nazis and things like that. But like, he was able to dive into it as an intellectual and able to, I guess, figure out what they were saying and deal with it. Like figure out what it is we need to do and say to deal with. And I think that it really helped me to, you know, to shape my way of thinking about this. But it's continually evolving, and I think that's a good thing. And I, like, you know, I'm just going to say thank you, Dad, for helping me evolve my perspective continually. So there's that.
I wish I had that. Because I straight up turned that shit off. We'll talk about it more later, but more to come.
You had a very different experience with your father. So.
Very different. He was listening to Rush Limbaugh.
But not ironically.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyways, moving on. Right. Timothy McVeigh.
Yes, getting into that.
Hang on. I had something relevant to say. Again, okay. I just remembered. Guess who was, I think I was living in Lewiston, Idaho. It's not that far, but it's really not that far. It was like 3.5 hours away.
Whoa, when it happened.
Yeah, so I lived up in... Okay, so here's what I wanted to say that was super relevant, was in 91, when Ruby Ridge happened, I was living in Lewiston, Idaho, which is in the panhandle portion of the state, the northern portion of the state, only about 3.5 miles south of Ruby Ridge. So when that was going down, of course, I was an infant. I was maybe 4 years old. But my mom says that she remembers watching the news, like the local news about it. So yeah, it was pretty interesting. And I, you know, I remember growing up in faint rumblings about it, but never really understanding what it was and what its relevance was. But looking back on it through this month has been incredible. And just thinking about how close I was at the time. And so it's very interesting. And then I got obsessed with Waco. So I can't wait to hear how your obsession in Oklahoma City has culminated.
Oh yeah, we're about to dive deep. So so getting into kind of the rest of the context, like I said, this like right-wingism, I guess, is on the rise. And it, I guess, escalated when Bill Clinton was selected. And then on November 30th of 1993, he signed into law the Brady Bill, which mandated background checks for guns and a 5-day waiting period, and also banned assault rifles. All good things, in my opinion. But
well, and it worked. Like, it worked.
Yeah.
The statistics and studies show that the bill worked before it expired and never got renewed.
And this is, like, also irrelevant, but around the same time in 1995 in Australia, they like, had a whole gun, like, they just
they did a buyback. Guns. And yes, they did a government buyback, no questions asked. And they bought back, I think, like 75% of the nation's guns and destroyed them. It was incredible. Yeah. And they haven't had shooting since.
Exactly. So there's that.
You know, but that's not why we're here to talk today. So sorry I put that in there. But
no, I didn't. It's me. I talked about Australia for whatever reason, because I can't stay on point to save my life. But anyway, So gun rights were already, they were becoming a thing. They became more of a thing in the 80s and then especially in the 90s after Waco. Waco was kind of like the rallying cry for gun rights activists and particularly for Timothy McVeigh. So who is Timothy McVeigh, Pisha?
Well, first of all, as we learned last week, homie was at Waco. He was there as it was happening during the 51 day siege. He was selling anti-government, right-wing, Nazi bumper stickers. Like, it was funny. He had 4 different styles. I looked them up. They were very basic, slogans. I won't repeat them, but they were very white supremacist, very right-wing. And so here's what we know about him. Timothy McVeigh was born on April 23rd, 1968. He was Irish-American, as you can tell from that name, maybe. And had a pretty standard childhood, which kind of surprised me. Most of these people have fucked up childhoods.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying, like, his dad wasn't, like, amazing.
Well, yeah, but neither is mine. You don't see me blowing up a federal building.
Fair enough. Keep going. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I just meant, like, standard in the sense of, like, it doesn't seem like he suffered really serious trauma or anything. Mm-hmm. He was
divorced when he was a teenager or something, and like his mom was in Florida. But like
that would traumatize anyone.
There it is.
So here's the deal. Maybe there wasn't like trauma in the unusual sense. It's your typical trauma that typical children would have, I guess. He was, however, very isolated because he was an asshole. He never had girlfriends or anything. I guess he opted to fuck his friends' wives, which also doesn't surprise me because that's like a very military guy thing to do. They all fuck each other, like all of them. But anyways.
You're not going to make many friends that way.
No. And obviously that led to him not having many friends. Fucking their wives would do that. So yeah. He became an infantryman in the Gulf War, which, if you don't remember, was in the Middle East.
That place.
I like how I'm like circling it as if everyone can see my brain map
going
on.
Exactly where
Thank you.
At.
Yeah. Thank you, Raven. But so he was fairly competent at war. He did a pretty good job. He met his only two real friends there, so I'd say it was pretty successful. And those two friends are Mike Fortier, or Fortier, I don't know, if you, whatever way you want to say it, it's French.
Sure.
And then we got Terry Nichols, our guy Terry Nichols. So we'll talk about these two a little bit more. In addition to what we've discussed already about Timothy McVeigh, he was a massive racist. He was reprimanded for wearing a white power shirt at a Ku Klux Klan rally, where there had been black power shirts during civil rights demonstrations. So he was kind of being a little douchebag and being like, oh yeah, you want to wear your black power? I'm going to wear my white power. It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
So,
not at all. And like, I don't know what his problem was. Like, one of the things that I remember reading was that like, he talks about his kind of progression into racism and talks about like how he would see like black people standing in line for welfare checks and things like that, and people on the porch and calling them slurs that I'm not going to repeat. And so that's where he like got his perspective on race.
Right.
But at the same time, like, I mean, I think you're going to talk about this, but he was also like, he was never employed. Like he didn't have any like leg to stand on when he's talking about other people and their like generalities, when he was also just like a massive loser.
Well, that's probably where the resentment comes from, right? Like you hear all these guys going, what white privilege? I don't have a job. I'm poor. And they think it doesn't exist because they personally are poor. He's kind of like that, where he has this casual racism based on his personal observations and anecdotes. And it slowly snowballed into a more vicious, malignant hate. And I think a lot of it had to do with resentment. He, as a white man who should have all this privilege, as society tells him, although I think white privilege came more under the scope of the media in the 2000s, probably. But I think we're amping up to that point, you know?
And a fair bit of action was happening at the time, too. Like, so he's seeing these things and allegedly seeing like people who are black or women as well. Like, I mean, he also hated women. Surprise, raging misogynist, like who would have figured? So anyway, like this is also an aside and I'm sorry, I keep getting off track, but like we talked about this earlier, Keisha, as well, but I'm reading the Malcolm X's autobiography, which is a great progression between Timothy McVeigh and Malcolm X. Both raging misogynists. So at least they would have something to talk about, if nothing else.
Right? So. Yeah, they might not agree on anything else, but
like literally anything else. But
yeah, but you know, back to McVeigh, you were right. He was this big fat loser. He was lazy. He couldn't hold down a civilian job after he was out of the military. He ate junk food. Not that anything's wrong with that necessarily. I don't really have a problem with it, but
that's not the problem.
But like, it's like a part of the whole persona, and it's. He sat around, he sold all this stupid propaganda and guns at gun shows, the bumper stickers at Waco, as we've talked about. And he was just this lazy piece of shit. That's really who he was.
Absolutely. Yeah, he totally was. And one of the things that came from this too, is that when he would go to these gun shows, like at first he was finally like finding his community of people after being in the military and not really like having any friends other than Mike Fortier and Terry Nichols. And he was hoping to make more friends. And ultimately he made like one more friend, Roger Moore, who we'll talk about a little bit later. He went to these gun shows thinking that he was going to meet his people and was ultimately kind of disappointed that like really all it was selling guns, which it only makes sense. But
yeah, turns out he was a loser and no one liked him from anywhere. And I think I saw was, you know, as he was growing up, he was this loner at school. He didn't have friends like we've discussed, but he grew to really hate bullies. Like that was something I noticed in his biography, mm-hmm. was that he has this hate for bullies, which I thought was kind of interesting because I associate white supremacists with bullies. But he would argue differently. He would argue that he's standing up for people who are being oppressed, right? And so he's right. standing up to the bullies. So I just think it's interesting that he kind of has grown up a loser, developed this hate for bullies, and of course he targets the federal government, the bullies, the ultimate bullies, right? They're That's coming exactly to take the guns. It. They're coming to take your money, your income. They're coming to take everything from you. And now they're telling you, you have to play nice with Black people, which he does not want to do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, yeah, so thanks for explaining Timothy McVeigh to us. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened and what led him to plan to bomb the Murrow building. So at some point, and I can't quite remember when he read this, it might have been in high school. I kind of want to think it, say it was in high school. He read a book called The Turner Diaries, which is a book that outlines white supremacist plot to basically bomb a federal building and take back the world that had become too inclusive. So that really, like, that shaped his life. He told everybody. He told his sister. He told Terry Nichols. He told everybody to read the Turner Diaries, like that. You know, take out the white supremacist stuff, but leave in everything else, because the federal government and taking away our guns is really something we have to worry about. So, you know, like we had mentioned before, he was horrified by Waco. He had actually talked to the student journalist, and she had, I think, went on to write a story about the way that he was selling the propaganda that he had sitting on the side of his truck. Like we said, he was at that point, I think, starting the plot to bomb the Murrah building. Waco happened on April 19th of 1993. And then April 19th was a big day for a lot of different reasons. One of the other reasons being was that Richard Snell, who was also a member of the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, this is a mouthful, but wow. Also known as the CSA, he was Christian Identity, white supremacist, and had killed a Jewish pawn shop owner as well as a Black Arkansas state trooper, along with a co-defendant who testified against him. Anyway, yeah, so what? Great guy.
Why? What? Enter All Richard Snell. Why?
Yeah. Because this was like, and we're going to talk a lot about this later, but, you know, white supremacy was really on the rise, and there was a lot of terrorist actions that were going on around the country. This wasn't a one-off. Like, again, I wanted to do this whole month because it is critical to what's happening today. And so, you know, you're looking at all these things that are happening in the 1990s that are all very connected. I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but it's not, because these are all white supremacists who are going around the country and committing all kinds of heinous crimes and hate crimes. And so in any case,
Richard did Snell, did he serve any sort of time for like the murders that he committed?
Well, so yes. So he was tried, he was convicted because his co-defendant, like I said, testified against him and ended up getting, I think, 30 years in prison or something like that. I can't remember his co-defendant's name, but in any case, he got the death penalty and he was scheduled to be executed. Ooh, I cannot remember if he actually was executed or not, on April 19th of 1995. So there's...
I remember this. I do remember this. I think he was supposed to be... He was set to be executed that day.
Right.
But I don't know if they actually did end up... There was some stay that took place and they didn't end up killing him until like a few days later, I think.
Something like that, yeah. And that's typical, like when it comes to death penalty stuff, is it takes years and years and years, because when you're going to kill somebody, when you have the government who has the force to be able to kill somebody, you want to have all the fail stops available to you. In case you're innocent, and it still doesn't work. And that's why we're still against the death penalty. And again, I don't need to go into that, but I mean, I will go off on everything right now. So you know why I'm against the death penalty.
Yeah, we know, but it's a fair point, you know, that Richard Snell, though guilty, he has used his constitutional rights to stay his execution. This execution was important because he was this like figure in white supremacy. Timothy McVeigh had been watching this. And so April 19th was super important. Also my dad's birthday.
All right, see all the things. Yeah, and so and one of the things that Richard Snell, just to tie a bow into that, what before he was executed was that he was very talkative, and he was telling the world basically to expect a bombing of a federal building on April 19th of 1995. He claimed some responsibility. And so that'll tie in later. We'll talk about that a little bit later. It's unknown whether or not Timothy McVeigh knew about this or not, or whether he was tied to this or not. I think he was asked about it. There was a 60 Minutes interview. I don't know if they asked him about that at that point, but I personally think that there was a connection. Like, I think that there just had to be, because the ideologies were just too intertwined. So it's all leading up to the reason for the planning behind the Murrah building. What happened was that he and Terry Nichols lived on a farm with Terry Nichols's brother, James, in Michigan. And they started developing this idea of how to build a bomb. He learned, I think, in the Gulf War, the makings of a bomb. And so he went to a couple different places, and actually got reported because he was trying to buy racing fuel and like massive amounts of it. And so one of the vendors like was tipped off about this and was like, I'm going to, you know, talk to the FBI about this. But I think he used a fake name. He tended to use a lot of fake names, so he wasn't caught at that point. And then the next stop, they didn't question it. And so he was able to mass a ton of racing fuel. And so they had a storage unit full of, I think, like 6,000 pounds of fertilizer, as well as, I can't remember how much racing fuel, but a ton. And so the idea was to create these bombs based on these ingredients. They also, I should mention, went to a local quarry and stole a bunch of dynamite from the quarry as well. I mentioned before that he had made friends with Roger Moore. One of the things about Timothy McVeigh was that he had no money. He was broke. He was trying to come up with all kinds of different ways of getting things that he might not otherwise be able to get. And so he convinced Terry Nichols to basically rob Roger Moore. And that was how they were able to bring together all of the ingredients that ultimately led them to be able to go across the country, which costs thousands of dollars, and commit this act. So Terry Nichols was kind of along for the ride for most of this and was basically doing his bidding. I heard it described, and this made me so sad. Do you remember Of Mice and Men at all?
Yeah. Of Lenny.
Yes, of Lenny.
And yeah. So, he gives off some mad Lenny vibes.
He does. He does. So I really think it was a Pinky and the Brain type of situation. Like, he just did not have the faculties to do this. And there was a lot of personal things happening in Terry Nichols's life. I think he and his wife were going through some troubles and things like that. And like I said, Timothy McVeigh was a massive loser. Like, he just didn't have anything going on in his life. One of the things that came out of this for me was, you know, I kept wondering if he had ever been loved, would this have happened? And I think that, you know, that is a conversation for a different day, but it is a common theme for a lot of violent men that they are lonely. They don't have any outlet of being able to express or feel love. And so that leads them down this like hateful, terrible path. I'm not justifying it. This is not what I'm saying at all.
No, but not at all. But I hear what you're saying. At what point could a well-intended hug have changed this person's, the course of their life? Like, just showing some love in a normal, natural way to these people. And when you talk about Terry Nichols particularly, he struggled in the Army because he wasn't considered very bright. Like, the guy wasn't very smart. And and so I think about if he had been just treated with a little more kindness and love and respect, and he wouldn't have needed to get the attention, the negative attention that he was getting from Timothy, the fulfillment he was getting from Timothy McVeigh. So right. Yeah, exactly. It's I do hear what you're saying. There's no justification, but it makes you wonder if it could have changed the course for some of these men.
Yeah, I guess that's the entire point. And I think we'll talk about this when we get to the takeaways in all of this, is that, you know, there is a lot of hatred and, you know, tribalism and things like that happen. And it's isolating, and I think it's destructive to the cause. And I'm not a kumbaya type of person, you know me. But at the same time, I do think that it is in human nature just to want to love and to be loved. So there's that. But, you know, none of that was available to Timothy McVeigh on April 19th of 1995. So he takes this Ryder truck. He takes the storage unit and fills it and creates these bombs using those barrels.
Those like big drums.
Yeah. And creates a cell inside of, and to point out that right before he had done this, he went out to go visit Mike Fortier and his wife, who were massive meth heads, right?
Sorry, I don't know why that made me laugh, but I was just like, oh yeah, of course these masterminds are meth heads. Let's just all gang. It's such a ragtag group of people. We got a dumb guy, we got a meth head, and then we've got a racist.
Yeah, really. I know, who were able to commit so much atrocities.
So much.
I know. So many atrocities. Anyway, so
an atrocity of magnitude.
Thank you. You're great at this.
We're so good.
So he goes out and visits Mike Fortier and his wife, and he actually lays out, I can't remember what he used as a, I think they were Coke cans, in the cell that he had configured that was going to create the bomb. So Mike Fortier and his wife knew exactly what he was going to do. He said he was going to bomb the Murrah building. He said exactly how he was going to do it. He was going to rent a rental truck and, you know, go and park it next to the building and fill it with explosives. He said that to them. He ends up filling the truck. Terry Nichols takes off. Terry Nichols leaves him a note and says, you know, you're on your own, basically. And so he goes off and he does it on his own. He rents a Ryder truck. I can't remember if he rented the Ryder truck in his name, or I think it might have been.
He did it in a different name, but he accidentally signed in his name.
Yeah, he did. So he was really sloppy. And that's part of the reason that he was caught, because you're right. So he signed it in his name. And so then he takes the Ryder truck and he stays in Kansas City a couple nights before the bombing. And he rents the room in a different name. And then he goes and gets Boo Boo Guy Pan. Boo Boo Guy Pan? Yes. That's
why do you know that?
Right? It's relevant, I promise.
Okay.
So he orders Moo Moo Gai Pan from a local Chinese restaurant. Right. So he used the name. That's how they were able to tie his fake name to him, because he was under the room of Timothy McVeigh, but used a different name for the Moo Moo Gai Pan. So death by Moo Moo Gai Pan, I guess. But anyway, So he rents the Ryder truck. He goes and drives to Oklahoma City, and he is scheduled to arrive just a few minutes after 9:00 a.m. So I think this is where you're going to take it away, Pisha, and tell us what happened.
Yeah, I'll take it away, but I have a few questions. One, sure. why did Mike Fortier not take any more action? Like, why did they not continue involvement? Was it just because he lost interest, or he chickened out, the same as Terry Nichols?
Meth.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. Okay, hang on. So we got Timothy McVeigh showing up to this Ryder truck, and the Ryder truck is just like, it's like a moving truck, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make sure that's what I'm envisioning.
It's a big old moving truck.
Right? Got it. Okay. Yeah. So,
and as you probably know, Ryder does not exist anymore because it was also the truck that was used in the World Trade Center bombing a few years
That's
ago.
Right. The first one. The first one. Yeah. Okay. So that's probably going to put you out of business if you get used for two bombings in a 10-year period. But yeah, so Timothy McVeigh actually had a lot of targets that he was considering when he was making this bomb. There were several federal buildings that he had visited or at least considered, I think, one of them being like Dallas. I think they had considered a few other places, but they had arrived on the Murrah building. Because
allegedly,
they think the ATF that some of the ATF that was involved in the Waco siege is headquartered in the Oklahoma City Federal Building, the Murrah Building. So there may be a connection there on why Timothy McVeigh chose this building in Oklahoma City. So Timothy McVeigh arrives basically to the front of this building, right? Like, I don't think he's shy about where he parks.
He's on this kind of on the side. Like, so, and I think it's like he parked his
on the north side of the building.
Right.
Okay.
So go ahead from there.
Okay. So, so Timothy McVeigh had parked his Ryder truck with the bomb on the north side of the building and just casually walked away. This is on April 19th, 1995, at just after 9 a.m. I think the official time of the explosion, because there were people who were actually recording at the time, there were certain recorded phone calls and stuff going
there,
on. Was
well, there was
nine,
a hearing.
Yeah, there was a hearing. Oh, that's what it was. It was a waterboard hearing.
That's right.
Yeah, so at exactly 9.02 a.m., the bomb exploded in the Alfred P. Murrah building, killing 168 people. There was a daycare center in there. I think it was on the first or the second floor. And 19 children were killed among the 168. And I guess three pregnant women, which in Texas means six people died.
Six people, yep.
So, or whatever draconian state is doing that now. But anyways,
Oklahoma.
Yeah, Oklahoma. There we go. So, so initially, people didn't believe it was possible that these could be domestic terrorists, that these could be Americans that did this horrible, atrocious bombing at this federal building. So the focus initially was on Middle Eastern individuals. Islamophobia was high during the time. We were dealing with the Gulf War, the aftermath of the Gulf War and Desert Storm and all this shit. And plus there was always like, you know, kind of a vague Islamophobia hanging over America forever.
Well, the World Trade Center bombing as well. It just happened. Right. So there was, you know, that too.
When did that happen? I thought that was in 96.
93.
Oh, it was 93? Okay, so there was... Okay, so there's...
I'm going to correct us.
I'm sure. But the point is, there's Islamophobia going on, whether it's warranted or not. And there were all of these tips coming in. Some people saw two Middle Eastern individuals, and some people still claim that there's Middle Eastern ties. But no one from any Middle Eastern terrorist groups have ever taken credit for the bombing. And so in an incredible...
Well, worse than that, I'm sorry to cut you off, but they were arresting, like, on site. Like, it was, like, one of those things that, as America likes to do, when another, you know, country of color becomes involved in something, whether it's true or not, they were arresting people and interrogating them without any real cause. So that was a problem. Yeah. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of problems, but it did, in a way, bring a huge, like, incredible showing of spirit for this country. It kind of allowed people to unify under this horrible, tragic event. And so there was this massive volunteer effort to rescue anyone who might have been in the rubble of the building and then restore the city. There was this huge vigil, you might remember. Yeah, I think I remember seeing pictures and videos and stuff of it.
Yeah, Bill Clinton was there. And I think that was the moment because, I mean, his poll numbers were atrocious at the time. I mean, he had lost control of the Senate and Congress. And once this happened, I mean, he really took hold of it. And to Clinton's credit, was right away said, I know these people. I know that this is, you know, homegrown is what he right. said. So right. in any case, keep going. I'm sorry.
Well, no, you were right. I mean, Clinton got the message. He knew that this was homegrown terrorism, and he knew that it was atrocious, but he was not the one who was falsely reporting that it was the worst act of terrorism or violence in Oklahoma's history. The media was doing that. Mm-hmm. Media was saying this was the worst act of terrorism in the state. They're wrong.
Absolutely wrong.
They're so wrong, it's not even funny. It was absolutely the Tulsa massacre that left 176 dead in 1921. I've heard more than 176 in some numbers. I've heard upwards of 300, and that we can never be sure of the true number because of how the town was taken down. No, that's a fair number. I wouldn't be surprised if it was double that because of how terrible it was. Yeah.
Well, and I think you're right. There's not a good number on it because it's been written out of our textbooks, which is
completely erased.
It's just insane to me that something so horrible can happen because, I mean, you're talking about homegrown. We're talking about 1995 and you have this like even worse massacre that's happened in 1921 that nobody's even left talking about. It's insane. So
yeah, anyway. less than 100 years later, like really, we have such a short sight of, you know, how this stuff works. But in less than 100 years, there were these terrible massacres, terrible terrorist events, all domestic, homegrown violence against our own.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's crazy because in theory, Timothy McVeigh could have gotten away with this like entirely, but he left such a trail of crumbs. Like he was such a dumb ass. One of the things that he did, so he had, I can't remember what he called his Mercury. It had like some like nickname, and he drove it out of Oklahoma City thinking that he got away scot-free. Okay. So McVeigh was driving his car without a license plate. And 75 miles down the road, there is an Oklahoma state trooper who is rushing in the other direction. I think he had just come off of some other crime that had occurred and was really like trying to get somewhere in a hurry. And all of a sudden he sees this car without a license plate on it. And so he decides to pull it over. Timothy McVeigh was driving the speed limit, like the exact speed limit at the time. And that's actually another reason that he was caught. So he pulls his car over and ultimately has Timothy McVeigh step out of the car as he's suspecting that it's a stolen vehicle. And Timothy McVeigh says, you know, oh, I just haven't had it registered, blah, blah. He's very like polite and friendly as like was his way. And he ends up, you know, arresting, like going to pat him down. And he says, I have a weapon. Well, in Oklahoma at the time, it is illegal to carry concealed. And so he is able to arrest him on that charge. This is like the most badass thing that I heard out of this whole thing. That's why I'm upset that I can't remember the state trooper's name. Someone will tell me it's like Hardy or something like that. Anyway, he's patting him down and Timothy McVeigh just tells him like, I have a weapon. And he goes, I have one too. And to Timothy McVeigh then, you know, I think he's like, he's still complying, but he says, mine's loaded. And the state trooper takes his gun, puts it to his head, and goes, mine is too.
What? Yeah. How did you get away with doing that?
Well, I don't know. Like, in any other situation, I would have been, like, horrified, because it's, like, not...
But it's Timothy McVeigh, so it's okay.
Yeah,
exactly. I agree. Wow.
So he arrests Timothy McVeigh, not knowing that he's caught the Oklahoma City bombing killer. And so they, you know, as you had mentioned before, there are thousands of tips that are coming in. A lot of them are wrong, but the FBI is, you know, to their credit, like following up on every single one. They are so far off, like on the identity of this person. All right. So when they started doing this investigation, they were able to pull the axle from the truck that they believed had caused the explosion. And that axle actually had the VIN number on it. And so they were able to track down where that Ryder truck came from and the rental company that that rented it to McVeigh. And Eldon Elliott is the one who was able to identify Timothy McVeigh. Eric McGowan, I think I mentioned him earlier, he identified Timothy McVeigh as renting a room at the Dreamland in Kansas City the Friday preceding the bombing that happened on Monday morning. But it was Yuhua Bai, who owned the little Chinese restaurant that I talked about that got Mugu Gai Pan, and that's what nailed him. So anyway, so once these tips were tied together, the FBI is basically in their major conference room, you know, trying to piece it together and find Timothy McVeigh. And they were able to find from jail records that he had been arrested and was awaiting a bond hearing. This is still, I just love this so much. Like, he was awaiting a bond hearing in, I can't remember, the next town over. And so, you know, he didn't have any criminal history. He was expected to be released on bond. He was just waiting for his hearing. So one of the agents calls over to the jail, and the way that they just describe this is just so perfect, because like, this guy had no idea. So they had heard rumblings about Oklahoma City. They just didn't put any of the pieces together. So this FBI guy calls over to the jail and says like, "Hey, do you have anyone in there, you know, who was just booked in maybe however long ago?" And the guy like is trying to tell them stories about how terrible his day is, and like just these weird, like random, like very petty things that are happening. And then, you know, he goes, "Oh, okay, well, let me just go ask around the office." And so he asks, he says, "Hey, did we just get someone in?" And they're like, "Yeah, we just got someone in, you know, however long ago." And they go, "Well, what's his name?" He goes, "Timothy McVeigh." And the whole like room just exploded. Like, they're just like, "We got him." So that's how they took down Timothy McVeigh.
Wow. So, you know what it reminds me of, but slightly less orchestrated, is how they got the Idaho student serial killer, the guy who was driving to Pennsylvania. It was, they knew where he was going. They were watching him, and these cops were deliberately tracking him all along the way. Slightly different in this situation, but he ended up getting pulled over like three times by three different like departments.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, it's crazy. So yeah, you just never know who you're pulling over, I guess. But the judge on his concealed carry case, you know, was going to release him and wanted to hold him over. But then the FBI came in and took him by a helicopter. And like, that was a whole epic ride to itself. But they took him to a federal facility. And then ultimately he was charged in a conspiracy case. So the case against Timothy McVeigh was extraordinarily strong. Like, the FBI did an incredible investigation that, I mean, I'm quite frankly very impressed by. They had all of the receipts. They had the phone calls actually between Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh, because they thought that they were being smart and carrying a certain phone that they had saw advertised in a rifle magazine that actually was very easily traced. And so they were able to get all of those calls and able to tie down the case against Timothy McVeigh.
They were able to like tie all of the evidence to like the ingredients for the bombs, like where, how much was bought where for how much. Like, they were, it was a really tight case. And where the feds fucked up in Ruby Ridge and Waco, they had it tight and together in this case.
Absolutely. Right. So Merrick Garland was basically the lead U.S. Attorney in this case, and he played very conservatively. And really, I mean, like, I think the biggest question to the rest of the country was why. But that's not what Merrick Garland or the U.S. Attorney's Office needed to prove. They just needed to prove that he did it, and that's what they did. So they weren't going to make this a big blow-up case for the media or anything like that. They were going to play it as by the rules as they could, so that he wouldn't have the ability for appeals or anything like that, that they were going to get the conviction that they had earned. And so this was actually really interesting, because I mean, I think Merrick Garland is a brilliant attorney. And I think that he did it exactly right. he allowed in the public, that he was able, he got every single one of his rights along the way. So it was a public trial. It was not in Oklahoma. It was moved because too many people would have been affected by it. The judge actually tried to stay on that case, which was ridiculous because there's no way. Like, I think that that judge, like, part of the building, like, anyway, was, like, very affected by this. So
right. Like, wasn't there a form, like, they used to be in that building, like, housed right. in that building at one point?
Exactly. So there's no way. Like, and they wanted to move it to, like, the next county, which was ridiculous as well.
not far enough.
Exactly. Well, and there's no way that they would have gotten a
impartial trial, jury.
Right. Because everybody knew about that when you have something that's so infamous. And so, like, you know, there was this joke about there being like a 10-year continuance, you know, waiting until people were, their feelings weren't so inflamed by it. But obviously that they couldn't do that. There's speedy trial stuff. So anyway, so Timothy McVeigh was kind of caught in this conundrum and did an attorney, Stephen Jones, who was a very good attorney and was like trying to play into politics a little bit, but in any case, like, he wanted to bring the case that the U.S. government was so inept and so incompetent that they couldn't try him properly. And he was, could not have been more wrong. So Stephen Jones and Timothy McVeigh butt heads a lot. And one of the biggest things that they butt heads on was whether or not there was more than one person. This case, Timothy McVeigh wanted to take full responsibility for it. In fact, Stephen Jones had a psych evaluation done on Timothy McVeigh, found out he was completely sane, and then also did, I think, two different polygraphs. But the thing is, this is the interesting part about this, is that the polygraphs showed that he was honest about everything else, except that he was the only one who was involved in this. So
interesting.
Take that for what it's worth, because I don't believe polygraphs and no one should, but it is interesting. And Timothy McVeigh was furious about failing that. So there was, like, I think a team of like 30 lawyers or something for Timothy McVeigh throughout this whole, the big question, I think, for Stephen Jones and for the rest of the legal team was what they could do with this idea that there may have been other people involved. And the reason that that became an issue was because the indictment talked about others unknown, which I think, Pisha, you might know a little bit more about.
Yeah. So this is a long form indictment, and it's pretty typical language to sweep in any sort of unknown co-conspirator that may have helped participate or been an accessory to the. So yeah, it's basic language that's usually put in boilerplate so that it sweeps in anyone who the government may be unaware of at the time of the filing of the indictment. It's not very mysterious language like it's being made out to be by Stephen Jones, who's a good attorney. But one of the areas he really wanted to attack and show where the government fucked up was that there were all these others unknown to conspire to bomb the building. And so while that wouldn't take any responsibility away from Timothy McVeigh, it would contribute to the idea that the government didn't look hard enough at other people who may have been involved, perhaps. So this is a big point of contention between Stephen Jones and Timothy McVeigh, his client, who was adamant that there were no others unknown. Everyone was known. It was him. And he was a lone wolf.
Yeah.
Well, right. And I think he admitted to the limited assistance by Mike Fortier and Terry Nichols, but he was very dismissive about the assistance they provided and took a lot of credit. He was, quote unquote, a lone wolf. And so there was a second person, though, who was initially identified as John Doe 2. He had been seen with McVeigh renting the vehicle. And so this was someone who was confused for someone else. They were able to rule right. this person out pretty quickly. But it contributed to this idea that maybe Timothy McVeigh was working with someone else and the government didn't care to follow up on all these other leads. And so Jones played to both sides. He would claim on one hand that the others unknown could have been these Muslims, because Muslims can't be American.
Apparently
not. Muslims are only from foreign countries. So, you know, when speaking to more of the right wing side, he would talk about these persons unknown being Muslim or brown and very scary in that regard. But when talking to the more liberal side, he would characterize it as white supremacists and domestic terrorism. So, you know, it has to be said, right? Well, Timothy McVeigh was a very avid Rush Limbaugh fan, and much of what he believed was parroted by Limbaugh and other right-wing talking heads. So I think it's important to mention that. It's not like he was an isolated figure with these beliefs. It's being perpetuated by pretty mainstream voices in the movement. But Republicans and right-wingers have done the same thing throughout history of denouncing the violence and refusing to accept any responsibility, never acknowledging the reality of right-wing domestic terrorism, no matter how many times it's happened. So they always are like, oh, thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers. We're really sad that this happened, but no, it's not domestic terrorism. We don't take any responsibility for the rhetoric or for the division amongst people. So it's pretty common that this happens. And I think this is a good place for me to insert my experience that I had I tried so hard to channel your father so that I could get the other side. I wanted to know what the other side was talking about. And I found this documentary. It's called The Noble Lie or A Noble Lie, something like that. And for those who don't know, a noble lie is a Plato philosophy that suggests it's a lie that is told that doesn't harm anyone for the purpose of maintaining harmony in society. So I was like, okay, I'm interested. What's the noble lie according to these people who think apparently that the Oklahoma City bombing is some sort of conspiracy? But it was so bad. The first 20 minutes, it was so racist. I tried so hard to just sit through it and try to see it from a different perspective without letting my rage interfere. And there was one woman who lost two of her grandchildren at the daycare in the bombing. And her evidence for why it wasn't Timothy McVeigh, even though McVeigh confesses and whatever, her evidence was that I just couldn't believe that an American would do this to children. Americans love their children. And
do we though?
And I was like, okay, every school shooting ever. And, right. You know, all the children living in poverty. In the system right now. It's just, no, they don't. We don't care about our children. Don't act like we are morally superior. Then I had a lot of other problems with her statement. First of all, the implication that Muslims don't care about their children, and also that Muslims aren't American. Like, I just, it was so racist and so bad. And I kept trying to like tell myself, this is a very hurt, wounded, grieving woman, and she wants to find answers. So I'm trying to forgive her for it. But when in the face of so much evidence, Timothy McVeigh saying, I did it, all the receipts the feds had, like they had a solid watertight case against him, you know, and she's still saying this isn't good enough. You know, that answer isn't good enough. And so I made it through 20 minutes of the documentary until they seriously, not in jest, interviewed Alex Jones. And he immediately said, oh, yeah, absolutely. The Oklahoma City bombing was a inside job and a cover-up. Government cover up. And I was like, I can't. And I just turned it off. I could not listen to it anymore. I feel like a failure. I want to know.
Oh my God.
I know I'm not, but it's like, I wanted to know what their side was. There was another hour and 40 minutes for me to understand. And it was so chaotic. The evidence wasn't evidence. It was a woman who wasn't testifying, saying what she heard another woman saw. And it's like, hang on, no, and they're all pissed off that their tips weren't taken seriously. And it's like, listen, there's a reason why these rules of evidence exist, to exclude evidence that may be inaccurate. And in this case, your tips were inaccurate because it's based on he said, she said, they saw. It's not firsthand knowledge. So it was the most ridiculous documentary I've ever seen in my entire life. I challenge you all to watch it and tell me how it ends and try to tell me what the noble lie is, because I don't understand how the government hiding that this was a broader conspiracy by white supremacists maintains harmony.
I don't know.
I don't know. I challenge you, Raven, to watch this, because I need someone rational to tell me what it all means.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a job I can save for my dad.
Perfect. He's the perfect guy for this.
Yeah, I'll ask him to do that for us. Some questions about, you know, what happened to some of the other people who were involved. So Mike Fortier and his wife were both asked initially about Timothy McVeigh, Terry Nichols, all these things. And they lied to law enforcement, which is a crime. And they said that they didn't know anything at all, which was, like I said, it was a lie, because he obviously had told them everything. So they actually played a very critical role in the trial itself, because after a while, they came back to him and were like, well, we found out that you're lying to us, so we're going to charge you. And what we'll do is we'll give you a plea agreement that gives you a much lower sentence if you just give us the information that we're asking for. So that's what happened to Mike Fortier and his wife. I think his wife may not have actually served time, although I can't
remember. I don't think she did.
Yeah, she might not have, but I know that he did. But
yeah.
It was not a significant amount of time. And he did cooperate against both Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. So that's what happened to them. And anyway... Yeah, this is, like I said, this has become like my greatest obsession of the year, or at least since February. So I'm happy that we were able to kind of wrap this up and put it all together into, you know, the context of Ruby Ridge and Waco. And I know that that's been done before. This is not anything new, but I think it's important to talk about, like I said, today, because it's very clear that this was not a lone wolf isolated incident, as it continues to be portrayed in the media. This is a threat that we have to contend with. This is something that we have to deal with and decide, you know, what is the best course of action in dealing with these incidents and this, you know, greater terrorism that's happening in this country. And so on a human level, you know, there's a question as to, you know, what we were talking about before. Can these people be saved if they're properly loved? You know, there's that. And I think we should probably do an episode, because I love this story so much and I talk about it so much, of the black guy who infiltrated the KKK.
Ku Klux. And, oh, yeah. The black Klansman.
And was able to pull them out of it. So I think the biggest thing, you know, like I said, and I'm reading Malcolm X right now too, and one of his big things is isolation from the white people. And so you see the dangers of that. And I'm not saying that I'm against what Malcolm X was saying. Like, I certainly believe in a lot of the things that he was saying.
Right. But it's a different context.
Right. Right. And there's a lot I disagree with, of course, too. And I think that the idea that you can solve any problems by separating people is entirely wrong. That's kind of my takeaway from both this and from, you know, looking into some of these, the other side, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So on the other hand, I mean, where my hang up is in all of this is Nazi Germany, because, you know, how far do we let this go? Like, would Germany have been able to prevent from spreading had they just hugged Nazis more? I don't know. I don't think so. So
yeah, there was way more. there was definitely more going on there, forces at play, socioeconomic. Well, for sure. But yeah, I do know what you mean, because the problem's not going away. And it, like you said, at what point do we take a stand against it? Because though Timothy McVeigh ultimately was put to death by the death penalty, and Terry Nichols is serving life in prison, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just because those guys are dealt with, so to speak, doesn't mean that this problem has gone away, and it continues. And as we're going to talk next week, it's still a problem. And so at what point do we take a stand against it? And what method and strategy do we use? I don't think hugs are like the universal cure, but I do wonder if bringing people out of their isolation, at least, and giving them social connection is the first step.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I think that what we were talking about with the prison riots as well, is that if you, like, they don't just disappear if you cancel them or if you put them in jail or whatever.
Right, you separate them from society.
Exactly. They still have to exist, and we still have to deal with them. Because I think the problem is, if you assume that they're going to stop existing, then it's only going to get worse. And so, you know, I don't know what the answer is. I guess the first step in any problem is acknowledging that you have a problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's, I've never been to AA, but I think that's part of it.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, I don't know. I probably should go. I mean, I don't drink alcohol anymore, but, you know, this might be good for me.
Sure. Maybe it's good for everybody. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, have we covered it this week?
Yeah, other than that Gypsy Rose and her husband split up.
That's right.
And she filed a restraining order against him.
Dang. Do we know, like, the grounds for the restraining order?
I don't. I was trying to look that up and I wasn't able to figure it out. But
who could have seen this coming?
Who would have known?
Oh, man. Well, I guess now love isn't real. I don't believe in love anymore.
I did up until Saturday.
Yeah, until they're getting a divorce and restraining order. God damn it, yeah. Gypsy Rose.
I know. It's just a bummer. It goes well, but it's sad. There were rumors that she was with her ex, but I think that, you know, both of them are saying that's not true, that they're just friends.
God, I hope she's not with her ex. We're not talking about the ex that murdered her. Okay, good.
No. Different ex.
Okay, just making sure. That would have been bad.
I think that she should start her own podcast called, like, Dating Tips with Gypsy Rose, because that girl gets around, like, in the best way possible. I mean that with all of the love in my heart. So.
Oh, yeah. Live your best life. I mean, yeah, she's going for it, so I can't talk down on that.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Well, that's it for Gypsy Rose and Ryan, and that's it for us. We have covered Oklahoma City bombing, and next week we're going to talk about how all of this, Ruby Ridge, Waco, the Oklahoma City bombing, how it all ties into the January 6th insurrection. So we will be talking about that next week. In the meantime, like, follow, subscribe, all of the social buzzwords.
Yeah.
Do it.
Send us emails.
Yeah. Hey, we've been getting some emails. Thank you guys for sending that. We appreciate it. And until next time, stay out of law school and the infirmaries.
Remember to like and subscribe to Deranged De Jure on your favorite podcast platform and follow at deranged.dejure on all the major social media. Contact us by email at deranged.dejure@gmail.com. This has been a Raven Kink production.